Genesis 44:1 to 45:15, the 41st talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 19, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 44. It is my intention to finish in time to have questions. There wasn't time for questions and comments last week, and I'm hoping to make that possible this time. You would think that standing up here I would have control over how long I take, but I don't seem to. I am kind of sprinting through Genesis here towards the end. I have three more weeks after today, and my goal is to finish up Genesis this stint. So that's why I'm covering as much as I am each week. Let me just recap what's happened, just briefly bring you up to date on what's happening in the story of Joseph here. If you'll recall, Joseph's family, Jacob and his sons back in Canaan, were experiencing the same famine that was happening throughout the Middle East during this period of time. And there was no food anywhere in Canaan, so the brothers were forced to go down to Egypt to get food. When they go down to Egypt to get food, they have to stand face to face with Joseph. But they do not recognize Joseph. Joseph apparently looks very Egyptian. He's older, and he's dressed very differently, and he's not speaking the language, his native language. So they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And he decides to use this opportunity to set up a situation for his brothers that will make them revisit their actions of the past, subject them to an injustice that they're going to have to deal with. On this first trip, when his brothers come, then he accuses them of being spies. And questions them, and they try to assure Joseph, no, we aren't spies, and they give information about their father and their younger brother. And Joseph says to them, well, to prove that you are honest men, go back and get your younger brother and bring him here. And in addition to that, Joseph instructs his steward to put their money back in their sacks, the money that they had used to purchase the grain. He puts back in their sacks, and they don't discover until later that money is in their hands, and that just complicates the issue. It makes it more difficult for them to prove that they are honest men. So they are very nervous. They go back home. They explain to Jacob what the situation is, and Jacob says, you are not taking Benjamin down. There's no way. Well, time passes, the famine continues, they run out of food, they have to do something. And Jacob realizes that something has to be done, so he says, go get some more grain from Egypt. And Judah says, let me remind you what the situation is. We cannot go unless we take Benjamin. And Judah pledges that he will make sure that Benjamin is safe. And if he fails, he will be to blame forever before his father. So Judah and the other brothers take Benjamin down. When they come to the area, Joseph sees them and has them invited to his house. Well, the brothers become very concerned. They've been invited to his house. They're convinced that they are going to be enslaved, pounced upon and enslaved because they stole this money. So they quickly go to the steward and explain to him the whole thing. We didn't know it was in there. We don't know what happened, et cetera, et cetera. And the steward says, don't worry, we got your money. I don't know what that money was doing there. Then they are invited in to have a feast with Joseph. Now, there are two things that happen at this feast that are a little unusual. The first is Joseph has them seated in order of age. In other words, Joseph already knew this. I shouldn't say Joseph. The vizier already knew the order of their ages and was able to place them in that order. And the brothers can't figure out how that could have happened. The other thing that happens is Benjamin gets a huge helping of food as opposed to what his brothers get. So he's obviously being singled out for special attention. Both of those must have struck them as being unusual. Now, as I think about this test, that this way of determining whether they are honest men or not, it has always bothered me. It's a little strange because let's assume that the 10 were spies. And they make up this story, well, our father's back at home and we have this younger brother, da 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 da. They're just listing a bunch of made up facts. Well, if Joseph says, to prove that you're honest men, go back and get your younger brother, all they would have to do is go back and get some young guy to say that he's their brother. So what kind of a test is it? The only way it would work, it seems to me, is if they bring this younger brother, Joseph separates him from the brothers and interrogates them thoroughly about information that only brothers would know. That seems to me the only way it would work is a valid test. Unless Joseph has divine knowledge, unless Joseph has the kind of access to God that God would tell him, yes, that's a brother, or something like that. And I think that's why these putting the brothers in order of their age becomes significant. Because now the brothers are faced with the fact that this vizier has access to knowledge that there's no reason to think that he should have access to. So I think that's why these facts are included. In any case, they eat their fill and they go to bed. They're going to take off the next day. And that's where we pick up the narrative in verse 1 of chapter 44. Then he commanded his house steward, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain. And he did as Joseph had told him. As soon as it was light, the men were sent away, they with their donkeys. They had just gone out of the city and were not far off when Joseph said to his house steward, up, follow the men. And when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this one from which my Lord drinks and which he indeed uses for divination? You have done wrong in doing this. So Joseph is setting up another injustice here. Joseph has stacked the deck. Once again, he has told his steward to put the money that the brothers had paid for their grain back into their sacks. So they're essentially again getting their money for free. He had done that before. The difference is this time he has also asked the steward to put his silver cup into the sack of the youngest. So that has all been done. Obviously, the steward is well briefed on what Joseph is up to. He had to have been well briefed, because the steward, every time he interacts with the brothers, he knows how to respond in a way that doesn't mess up what Joseph is doing. So the steward does all of this, all that he's been asked to do. The brothers pack up and they take off. And Joseph has instructed him to to catch up with them, and he's supposed to check and find the cup, accuse them of doing wrong, and find where the cup is. Now, this cup, it's interesting, this cup is made out of silver. Silver has entered into this narrative before. When Joseph was sold into slavery, it was for 20, 30 pieces of silver, some round number pieces of silver. So silver played into it when Joseph was first sold into slavery, and now silver is going to play a role in the resolution to this story. This cup is a cup that it says he uses for divination. Now, apparently there is evidence that later in Egyptian history, divination was done with cups, where a cup of water would be placed before the diviner, and then he would put drops of oil in it and watch to see what those drops did. And based on what they did, he could forecast the future. But there apparently is not evidence that that was done at this time in Egypt. It may have been done, but there's no evidence that it was done. And in any case, are we to understand that Joseph has the practice of performing divination, that Joseph does this kind of thing? It's possible, but earlier in Joseph's career, there's no indication that he was using some device to do divination. Remember the first one, he had the two dreams that he told to his brother and his family. Those were left uninterpreted by him. But then in the prison, he has the dream of the baker and the, who's the other guy? Cupbearer. He has those two dreams. He interprets those. But there's no indication that he uses a cup or a device to do that. Then he interprets the dreams of the Pharaoh. Again, no indication that he's used a cup or a device. And he clearly ascribes his ability to interpret to God. I think it's unlikely that Joseph is actually using this cup for divination. It's possible, but I think it's unlikely. I think, in fact, what he's doing is making it clear to the brothers that he is this mysterious character who has direct access to God. And they have stolen this cup that he uses to gain his access to God. So he knows things that he ought not know. And that's what he's making clear to them. Okay. The next section. Now they have the search for the cup, verse 6 through 13. So he overtook them and spoke these words to them. And they said to him, "Why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money which we found in the mouth of your sacks, we have brought back from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves." So he said, "Now let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and the rest of you shall be innocent." Then they hurried. Each man lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. And he searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and when each man loaded his donkey, they returned to the city. So just as Joseph had instructed, the steward goes chasing after them. Now, presumably, it's not the steward alone. Presumably, he's got people with him. He's going to take on 10 men. So presumably, he's got help with him. And I suspect it's a small armed guard that goes with him. And it must have been rather ominous to have this little guard of Egyptians coming running after them. He overtakes them and he says, and he tells them what Joseph had said that he was to say. That is, "Why have you returned evil for good? And they're thinking, we didn't do anything. We are as innocent as can be. And as proof of their innocence and proof of their honesty, they remind the steward that they had offered to return the money that they had in their bags on the previous trip. As proof of their honesty, if we were the type that would steal, we would never have told you that that money was there and offered to give it back. Furthermore, they are so convinced of their innocence that they offer draconian penalties if they are found to be guilty. And the draconian penalties are death to the person in whose sack the cup is found, and everyone else will be a slave. Well, the steward hears this, and he says, what's he say? Let it also be according to your words. Well, when he says that, apparently all that he's agreeing to is, yes, let's have a search, and yes, let there be a penalty. But he changes the terms of the penalty. The steward doesn't want, and I'm sure on the instructions of Joseph, he doesn't want the draconian kind of penalty that's been offered by the brothers. He makes it much simpler. He says, whoever has the cup, let him be a slave, and everybody else can go. That's all that's necessary. So, they unpile their bags, and the brothers are there, and the steward, with a flair for the dramatic, starts with the oldest and works his way down, opening the bags to get down to the youngest. Now, it must have been disconcerting when they open the first bag, and once again, the money's there. Once again, there are things in the bags that they didn't know were there. And with every bag that's opened up, they're seeing the money again, and they're probably going, every time the cup is not found, they're going, whew. But it gets down to Benjamin, they open the bag, and there's the cup. And now their hearts must all be sinking. That's the worst thing that could have happened, is that cup would be in Benjamin's bag. The response of the brothers is interesting here. They tore their garments as a sign of mourning. Now, we've seen torn garments before as a sign of mourning. When Jacob learned that Joseph was missing, Jacob went into mourning and he tore his garments. The brothers at that time didn't tear their garments in mourning, but this time they are. So the brothers then, they decide, we are going back with Benjamin. We are going to share the fate with him. We are not going to abandon him. So they all pack up and they head back to the city with this guard escorting Benjamin back. So now they come back and face Joseph again in verse 14. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. And they fell to the ground before him. And Joseph said to them, what is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination? So Judah said, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. But he said, far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father. So they come back and appear before Joseph once again. And this must be the most tense time that they've met with Joseph. The others have been tense, but this has to be the most difficult. So they fall down on the ground before him once again. And Joseph says, what have you done? Why'd you do this? Don't you know that I can divine? Don't you know that I can tell when you're doing things like this, that you can't get away? And Judah's response is, I think, a response that comes out of his state of mind that's been created over the past series of incidents that he has had with Joseph. That the brothers have not done anything that is blameworthy with respect to the vizier of Egypt. In this particular instance, their hands are clean, but they have dirty hands from the past. They have dirty consciences. And they seem to have come to understand that God has caught up with them, that what's happening now is unjust in a sense, but in another sense, it's very just. It's their deeds of the past that have caught up with them. So what Judah says is, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. He doesn't argue we're innocent. He just pleads that we are guilty. Make us all slaves. That would be the fair judgment. So this is a second offer now, that they all become slaves of this vizier. Joseph's response is, no, that's too harsh. I'm not interested in draconian measures here. I just want the guilty person to be punished. That guilty person will be my slave. The rest of you can go in peace to your father. Ironic, because with their guilty consciences, there would be no way that they could go in peace to their father. Okay, next section. In this next section, Judah gives a rather remarkable speech. Verse 18. Then Judah approached him and said, O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, Have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, We have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. But we said to my Lord, The lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. You said to your servants, however, Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again. Thus it came about, when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, Go back, buy us a little food. But we said, We cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. And your servant, my father, said to us, You know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me. And I said, Surely he is torn in pieces, and I have not seen him since. And if you take this one also from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will come about when he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, If I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain, instead of the lad, a slave to my lord. And let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest I see the evil that would overtake my father? This is a remarkable speech because it is heartfelt, It is very honest. He is not appealing to the vizier's compassion in a sense of playing up the situation and making him feel sorry for Judah. He's just laying out the facts and asking man to man if he would have mercy on Judah and allow him to substitute this other way of dealing with the situation. So it's a really remarkable speech. For the most part, it is just a recounting of events that we've already talked about, so I won't go through the speech piece by piece. But there must be a couple of things here that stand out. One is that Jacob referred to Benjamin as his only son by his wife. Once again, kind of emphasizing the fact that Joseph and Benjamin are the favored brothers. And Judah is able to relate this without choking on his words. He's come to terms with that. That's just the way it is. And he's okay with that. And the little bits of detail that it talks about the disappearance of the other brother, he's recounting the words of Jacob. The one went out from me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. Well, as Judah is saying those words, that must have struck Joseph, been very emotional for him to hear. But the main concern here on Judah's part is he doesn't want his father to be hurt. He's been through that before with Joseph, and he saw Jacob's reaction to that, and he can't bear to see that happen again. So he must save Benjamin and take him back to his father. So what he offers is that he become a slave to Joseph rather than Benjamin. Let Benjamin go back and let Jacob be spared that grief. It's a remarkably selfless speech coming from Judah, who had not shown selflessness up to this point. Okay, Joseph then reveals who he is in this next section. Chapter 45, verses 1 through 15. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried, have everyone go out from me. So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer. And he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve you for a remnant in the earth, and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his household, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. And you shall live in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all you have. There I will also provide for you, for there are still 5 years of famine to come, lest you and your household and all that you have be impoverished. And behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth which is speaking to you. Now you must tell my father of all my splendor in Egypt, and all that you have seen, and you must hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept on them, and afterward his brothers talked with him. So it has come to the point where Joseph can no longer control himself. There are two other times when he had to leave their presence because he was overcome with an emotion and was beginning to cry. But this time, he can no longer contain himself in front of them. So he has everyone else leave the hall. So it's just Joseph with his brothers. And it's at that point that he reveals to them that he is Joseph, their brother. And obviously, this must have been a huge shock. They seem to have had no inkling that that would be the case. This vizier has been weird. This vizier has been able to, has known things that they could not account for. But there's no reason to think that they had any inkling that this was Joseph. I think they had forgotten the dreams completely. So Joseph reveals to them who he is, and there's a lot of crying, and it's loud crying, because everyone in the household hears it. And the Pharaoh hears about it, so it must have been a big event. He reveals the fact that he is Joseph to them and says immediately, "Is my father still alive?" He's already asked them. This is obviously something that's much on his mind. And he wants to know, is he really alive? He's really concerned about that particular question. His brothers are too stunned to answer. They don't know what to say. They're speechless. Joseph recognizes this, and he says, "Come closer." Come close. By saying "come closer," he is no longer going to relate to them as vizier, but now he wants to relate to them as brother. Come closer. They're on more intimate terms here and more forgiving terms. They come closer, and once again he reiterates, "Yes, I am your brother Joseph." But then he quickly goes on to say, "But don't blame yourselves. God did this along with you. Yes, you did evil, but God was in control of you doing that evil, such that God was able through that to make provision and bring about a salvation for the descendants of Abraham, for the remnant." So Joseph has clearly come to see this whole episode as something that was orchestrated by God from the very beginning. That yes, his brothers did evil with respect to him, but they did nothing that was out of the control of God. That God had engineered all of this for his purposes and his good purposes. And that's what he is stressing to his brothers. Joseph has clearly come to terms with that. It's his brothers now that have to come to terms with that. He tells them then, "Go back. Go back to Canaan. Get our father and the whole household and your flocks and bring them down, because there are going to be 5 more years of famine. This thing has just barely begun. And lest you be completely drained of resources, come down here." This is the provision that God had made and was making from the very beginning for you. "Come down here. You will live in the land of Goshen. And as best as we can determine, as best as people who know can determine, that's northeast Egypt. So it's just east of the Delta area. And it's good pasture land. So it's land that's well suited for shepherds, not well suited for farmers. So that's where they will end up. And Joseph will make sure that they are cared for this period of the famine. This is the way that they will escape starving to death. Then he breaks down and he weeps on Benjamin's shoulders, neck first, because he has missed out on seeing his whole brother grow up. And so the emotion that brings out must be especially great. But then, in an act of true forgiveness, he is able to, he weeps on the neck of each of his brothers, because he is able to sincerely say, I'm glad to see you. That Joseph has come to terms with this. He had come to terms with what they had done with him even before his brothers showed up, in a sense, as I understand it. But now he's able to actually reconcile with them. It will take them longer to reconcile with him. And then the last line is probably the most curious of this section. And afterwards, his brothers talked with him. I would like to know what they said. That apparently they just sit down and they share the events that have happened to them in this intervening period of time. And it must have been a very emotional and interesting exchange for both parties. Okay, a couple things. First one, what was Joseph doing? We talked about this a little bit before, but we're in a better position to talk about a little bit more. Joseph set up a situation of injustice, and as I argued before, I think what Joseph has concluded is that Joseph had learned an enormous amount from injustices that he had experienced. He has forgiven his brothers. I think he truly has. But he realizes that they need to come to terms with what they have done. And he realizes that they can learn a great deal from injustice, just as he has. So he sets up a situation that is an injustice. He wants to find out. He wants to set up a situation in which he can find out, have my brothers changed? And have they faced into what they did to me? Because he knows that it would be good for them to do so. And if they have not done so, he wants to engineer a situation in which they have to do so. Now, I think that to a certain extent, Joseph is making this up as he goes along. I don't think he had a master plan from the beginning. He didn't expect to see his brothers. They just show up in front of him one day. And his first response, I think, was twofold. One is vengeance, and I want to see Benjamin. Now, how can I bring those things about? And it's at that point that he accuses them of being spies, and he has them all thrown into prison. And says that he's going to let one of them go back to Canaan and get Benjamin and bring him back. And then remember, it's a 3-day period of time that they're in prison, that Joseph, I think, begins to reflect on his situation. And it's at this point that a bigger plan starts to come together. And as well, Joseph is able to come to terms and resolve in himself that it's not revenge that he wants, but rather he wants his brothers to learn from this situation. So then he apparently comes up with at least the rough outline of a scheme. That is, he's going to send all the brothers except one back to get Benjamin. He knows they'll have to come back because they're going to run out of food. They'll get Benjamin and bring him back. And I think right from the beginning, right at that point, he knows that he is going to set Benjamin up, so that Benjamin will be unjustly punished for theft. Now, I think that it had to have been a scheme that he more or less planned, because, as we've noted along the way, the steward plays a key role in it. He has to brief the steward on what to say in order for this thing to work at various places. And at those places, the steward always says the right thing. So he must have come up with some plan, and he has shared that with the steward. The steward is a co-conspirator with him in this. And the features of this plan, the things that he wants to accomplish, is he wants to put the younger brother in a situation where they would be jealous of him. And he wants to put them into a situation where they have to decide whether they are indifferent to the feelings of their father, and to see if they are indifferent to the feelings of their favored brother. In other words, what he's trying to determine is, if they had it to do over again, would they do what they did to Joseph those years before? And I think the result is that Joseph sees that Judah is Judah in particular. I should put it this way. He sees that his brothers are transformed men. But he sees that most clearly in Judah, who seems to be representative of the odyssey that all of the brothers have gone through. Judah is a changed man by the time we get to the end of this scenario. His speech, I think, is quite remarkable. It shows a great deal of humility and, I think, contrition. He cares about his favored younger brother deeply. He is repentant for what he did to Joseph. And I think there are indications in the speech, as I've pointed out, that that's the case. And he is willing to sacrifice himself so that Benjamin doesn't have to be taken into slavery. I pointed out earlier in the chapter of Judah and Tamar that I think that the theme there, the thing that we are supposed to see, is that Judah was an irresponsible man. And we have seen Judah do a complete turnaround to the place now where Judah is a highly responsible man. He takes his responsibilities seriously, and he is going to carry them out, even if it means sacrificing himself. And he seems to accept full responsibility, not only for Benjamin, as he had promised to his father, but for his guilt for things in the past, his guilt for what he had done to Joseph. And his brothers seem to be similarly contrite. And seeing this contrition, Joseph is able, he had forgiven them, but you can forgive and not be fully reconciled. But he has forgiven them, now he sees their contrition, and now is able to be fully reconciled, emotionally reconciled. So Judah then is exemplary of what has happened to his brothers in general. They have come to terms with what they had done to Joseph. For years, their conscience has been plaguing them. And that all is forced up to the surface with the events that Joseph has put into motion. And they have come to the place where they're genuinely sorry for what they had done. Okay, I have left some times for questions and comments. Now, these can be questions or comments on last week's stuff or this week's.
Well, I was thinking last week, we talked quite a bit about Jacob, and if I understood you correctly at the end, as you were summarizing, you were indicating that you felt like Jacob had come to a point of faith in his willingness to allow Benjamin to go. And I'm not sure I totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple reasons. One is the text, and one is my own experience. So if Jacob had really come to a place of surrendering to God and to God's plan, and consequently was willing to let Benjamin go, he sure didn't tell it to Judah or any of his brothers, because they really had the attitude, if we go back without Benjamin, I mean, he's going to have a stroke. I mean, before I even get the sentence out. So, but really what I think is convincing to me is that Jacob is so much like me. He has a plan for his life. His motto is, I love myself and I have a wonderful plan for my life. you know, you idiot, why did you even tell him you had a younger son? And he says, all these things are against me. And that, it's that phrase that really struck me as kind of my attitude.
Right.
All these things are against me.
Right.
I know I'm on God's side. I have this wonderful plan about how God's going to work out his will in my life. And I'm constantly frustrated. And therefore, God's constantly frustrated.
Right.
But it's this nonsense. We want to believe that God is our co-pilot. I'm the pilot. God's the co-pilot.
Right.
You know, if something goes wrong with me and I can't quite handle things, God will step in and fix it, and then I'll be back on track and I'll take over and I'll land this thing. But it's just not real. He's not just the co-pilot. He's the pilot. He's the ground crew. He's the navigator. He's the stewardess handing out the corn nuts. He's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And at the opening of The Simpsons, there's this scene where Maggie, the little baby, is steering the vehicle, and you hear the tire. She turns this way, and the tires squeal, and she turns this way, and the tires squeal. And then the camera backs off, and you see she's just got this little plastic wheel in front of her, and she's in the car seat. This is before they just outlawed plastic things on the fronts of car seats. But, and of course, her mom is driving. Now, I'm not saying I watched The Simpsons or anything, but that's what my life is like. I mean, I'm on an airplane, and I've got this Kenner flight deck dashboard thing in front of me, or we're all on this airplane, and we've got, and we think we're controlling our lives, and we all think we're in control, and we're really not. And I think that this seems to be a pattern, because Abraham thought he had a plan for how God was going to work out his will through Abraham's life. But Abraham, I think, really did have faith, because he stood there with Isaac on the altar and said, I don't know how, this is totally contrary to my vision of how you're going to work out your plan, but I trust you. I'm not sure Jacob is quite there yet. I don't think Jacob could have even imagined what God was doing in his life through the loss of, I mean, he can't even imagine that Joseph is still alive, much less that God would use Joseph to save him and his family from starvation. It's just a mind-blowing thing. And Joseph begins to see how God's working in his life. And I just hope, you know, that I can get to a place sometime in my life where I can see back how God, how in control God was, and how out of control I was, and have the humility to know that his plans were far better than mine. You know, while I was working on plan B and plan C and plan D, he was still working plan A,
right.
And he wasn't going to let anything stop it.
Right. Yeah. I think it is definitely the case that in Jacob's interaction with his brothers, that he cannot trust God for Benjamin's fate. I mean, he's clinging to Benjamin desperately. But it's at the end of that interaction, he says, basically, if he's going to die, he's going to die. God have mercy on us. And I think it's at that point that he comes to a measure of resolution where he's saying, well, God's going to do what he's going to do, and I know God loves me, and so let him do what he's going to do. But I'm sure he's saying that in the same spirit that we have said it any number of times. It's, God, I know that you're in control. I know that you love me. Do what you're going to do, but please do what I want you to do. I mean, it's always kind of with our fingers crossed to a certain extent. And I think that's what's happening with Jacob, that he is just barely able to come to that place where he says, God, do what you're going to do. But to be able to just barely come to that is still significant. Yeah. And I think that's what we see in Jacob.
There are times when we see in the Old Testament, pointers toward the life of Christ. You see that sometimes in the Psalms, etc. I'm wondering if there's any significance if we should see any significance between Joseph being betrayed for silver and Jesus being betrayed for silver.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of, striking parallels between what's being talked about here and possibly with Christ, possibly with just the people of Israel in general. But it's important to see that, to not interpret this as an allegory, that it is, there's not this one-to-one correspondence between what's happening in the story of Joseph and what happens with Jesus, but rather to see this as indicative of the way that God acts towards man and the way that man acts towards God. I think we see several things like that here. For instance, when the brothers take Joseph and sell him into slavery, that was rebelliousness against God, much like the Jews taking Jesus and putting him on the cross. So I think that there are some parallels in that sense. I also think that we are encouraged to see Joseph as a kind of godlike figure with respect to his brothers. He knows more than they do. He's more powerful than they are. And so in some respects, that what he does with respect to them parallels what happens between us and God. And one of those is we suffer. And we suffer and we can't figure out why. It makes no sense. We shouldn't be suffering. But God knows better. God knows more. And that in the bigger scheme of things, it's actually a loving thing that is taking place. And I think we see that in this story as well. So I don't think we should see this as an allegory, but there are some dynamics here in the story that have parallels elsewhere, and I think even with Jesus.
Is it possible that one of the things that really was the turning point for Judah was losing two of his three sons and being so that being such a painful situation and his being so concerned about losing his last son that he wouldn't give her to Tamar, that he began to understand what his father was going through, losing Joseph, and just was not willing to put him through that with Benjamin?
I hadn't thought of that, but that's possible. I mean, we all know the phenomenon of disregarding the feelings of someone else in one situation and then only later have something like that happen to us such that we can identify with that now in a way that we couldn't before. That's possible. Judah's sons were not nice guys, however. So it's a little bit of a different situation. I don't know to what extent he truly mourned their demise. But nevertheless, that's possible.
He was afraid of losing his youngest son, and maybe his youngest son was a different kind of a person.
Yes.
It also, this is kind of interesting. This story is interesting to me because I always wondered why the tribe of Judah was picked to be the tribe from which Jesus came. And what he does in being innocent in this particular situation, and I don't know if they even were confident that Benjamin hadn't stolen that cup. Mm-hmm. They didn't know how it got there, and certainly I'm thinking one of the reasons, one of the fact that they tore their garments could have been, I mean, I'm guessing that they probably thought it, one explanation that was as reasonable as anything else is that Benjamin actually had stolen this cup. And so Judah knew he hadn't stolen the cup, and he was willing to substitute for Benjamin, who may very well have stolen the cup. And that's a very, the innocent dying or substituting themselves for the guilty is a very messianic thing to do. And I wondered, why do you think Judah's tribe was picked to be the ancestor of Jesus? Could that have been it?
Well, it is an interesting parallel, and that could play a part in it. The thing that's more explicit, I think, is that Reuben and Simeon have, in one way, Reuben, Simeon, and I can't remember whether Judah was number three or number four, but the older ones have all, in one way or another, demonstrated that they are not the ones to inherit, that they have done things that disqualify them. So it makes sense as Jacob is looking at his brothers, at his sons, which one would he have inherit? And he starts at the oldest and he works his way down. And Judah has shown himself to be responsible. And so he should inherit. Now, whether it goes further than that, I don't know. It's possible.
Last question. It seems like all of the patriarchs have issues regarding their sons. The threatened loss of their son. Abraham almost loses Isaac. Does Isaac have a thing with his sons? Well, he just has...
Just the fighting between the two.
Yeah.
And then Jacob leaves and is gone for an extended period
right.
of time.
I was just wondering if this seems kind of stretching it to me, but I just wondered about this common theme of losing your son, or if your son being sacrificed might be an echo of the God sacrificing his son, losing mm-hmm. his son, mm-hmm. losing and finding his son.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, at least in Genesis, the theme is a pretty strong one, that this line that God set in motion with Abraham and his descendants, we are struck time and time again at the fact that that line barely survives. That there are a number of times when it looks like it's not going to make it. And yet God comes through and somehow allows them to survive. And we see through that the faithfulness of God to his promises. So that, I think, is the stronger theme. What you suggest may be the case as well.
And also, another thing I've often wondered about is when they allocated the provinces for the 12 tribes, that Judah and Benjamin were close together. Mm-hmm. I often wondered why the different tribes were given different things, and maybe it had to do with the way they supported themselves. Some were more into commerce, so they were given large cities. Some were more shepherds and were given good pasture mm-hmm. land. But I wondered if the proximity of Judah and Benjamin might have been because of what Judah did.
That's interesting. Yeah, that could be.
I wondered if you'd speak to a question I have about why the writers changing reference to Jacob in chapter 42, mm-hmm. and then he's spoken of as Israel in mm-hmm. 43, mm-hmm. and what significance you see in that. Were there I think there's some symbolic significance there, and I wonder if you'd speak to that.
Yeah. Yes, I think there's symbolic significance to that. What is it? I'm not sure. I'm convinced that when the author uses the names, when he decides whether to call him Jacob or Israel, that that's not just a flip of the coin and it's not a stylistic thing, that there's content to that change. There is another change that happens in that same passage that I think is probably related to the change from Jacob to Israel, and that is the brothers begin to be referred to as the men. So I think my suspicion is that the author is encouraging us to see Joseph as a godlike figure with respect to mankind, rather than a Joseph, a brother, responding to his brothers. And that Jacob, we are to encourage to see him not as the father of his 12 sons, but as the head of the nation Israel. So I think in that chapter, we're being encouraged to think in more global terms than just this family dispute. Now, exactly how to flesh all that out, I'm not sure, but I think something along those lines is happening. I think those indicators are significant. It's hard to put them together, but I think those are very significant.
Right. I even wondered if there was a way that as we become Christians and go through our life, when we step back into our fallenness and make issues out of things or make decisions out of things that aren't good, we become more Jacob-like. And then as we, you know, come back around to who we are in Christ and that new creature we're becoming, and God keeps responding to us and giving us the will to respond to him, that we become more Israel.
Mm-hmm.
We have that. I don't know if there's mm-hmm. that stance in there, too, in mm-hmm. our own private lives as we mm-hmm. mature.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that. But I think there is something like that happening. Exactly what significance to attach to Jacob, the name Jacob, and what significance to attach to the name
Israel,
Israel, I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
You had said you were going to look back at the Akhenaten's rule.
I forgot to.
And his monotheism. Okay. There, the curious absence of any of these records in the Egyptian Hall of Records.
Yes.
You want to address that?
Well, I don't know that we can describe it as a curious absence, because the Egyptian records are not complete. That there are periods of time in which we know quite a bit about the history of Egypt. There are other periods of time in which we know almost nothing. So, for instance, the first intermediate period, the second intermediate period, we know almost nothing in those times. The Old Kingdom, we know a fair amount. The Middle Kingdom, we know quite a bit. And the New Kingdom, we know a lot. So the records are not complete. To attach significance to a period of time that we don't know about, that's hard to say. Okay, we need to let people go. Thanks.